Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of It's Easy, Son, your life lessons on your journey to your purpose. And this week, we have with us, I consider an icon in our American cultural affairs, civil rights, theologian, scholar, you name it. This gentleman is that and more. And as we go through this month of Black History Month, to have my guest, this guest with me today is both an honor and a privilege. Ladies and gentlemen, this week we bring to the podcast none other than Dr. Otis Moss Jr. And Dr. Moss, welcome to the show.
Thank you, and blessings upon you for your good works. And I'm honored to share these moments with you and with your audience.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much. Well, what we will do is we'll jump right in. These podcasts are done to inspire as much as we can our generation of young folks and people who, for lack of a better word, have seen current circumstances that have been troubling and not seeing their way out. So what we do is I ask open-ended questions, and based on the responses, we get some sense of your history, your time, and your impact that you have had on the world. And we start just by starting out by asking, who is Dr. Otis Moss Jr.?
Well, I like to think of myself as a servant of God, a husband, a father, a pastor, and participant in the human rights struggle for all of my adult years, beginning from college days down to this very hour when the sun is setting. And yet I am most encouraged and grateful to God that a new generation, well prepared and courageous, a new generation is making known their commitment to love, justice, and liberation. And they are marching and walking and working, producing and creating, unafraid, our children, our grandchildren, and those who will come after, continue to carry the torch, the light, the message, the deeds of liberation, justice, and freedom.
That is so.
So I go down to my grave with a shout. In spite of all of the brutality that constantly unfolds before our very eyes.
Wow, that is so powerful, Dr. Moss. Now, I will tell you, while I was doing my research and making sure I've read up as a Morehouse man, I made sure I had to be prepared. I'm a Howard man, but your name resonates with so many people. And over the last couple of months, I was blessed to watch a sermon that you preached at Howard University at Rankin Chapel. And you mentioned 4 points that talks about a life goals that would be one of purpose, mission, commitment, and service. Those 4 tenets, if you could talk to us a little bit about your early years and how those tenets developed that now are guiding posts, if you will, for you delivering such a sermon on the campus of Howard University.
Thank you. In spite of the racist and brutal circumstances playing such a role in the time and place where I was born and grew up, there were redeeming factors found primarily in family, the African American church, the African American school, though inadequately furnished and equipped, and the African American community. These were the in spite of forces and presence surrounding us and lifting us and encouraging us. And in our early years, we heard and felt the sound of the drumbeat of justice and freedom. Our parents and our surrounding elders shared with us their stories, their overcoming experiences, and all of the things that they had encountered on a day-to-day basis. And they planted in us, shall I say, an undying fire of aspiration, dreams, and motives that would last a lifetime. And we sought to live out a charge that we had to keep and to glorify God and lift each other along the path of struggle and strides, and gained strength, and sought to empower each other by the grace of God and the wisdom of our parents, our teachers, our mentors, for which we are eternally grateful.
Amen. One of the things that, as you were talking, something hit me. Last year, during the election cycle, you and your son, Otis Moss III, someone that I met while I was at Morehouse as the chief financial officer,
yes.
Otis' dream, and you talked about your father and his wanting to vote. I took away from that mini, I guess you could say, mini movie or clip, a father figure in your life that was determined and was unafraid to go after what he thought was right. What was the Moss household like when you were growing up? What was that experience like?
One, we lived in the country on a farm out from the city of LaGrange, Georgia, in Troup County, where segregation, racist, Jim Crow laws were powerfully enforced. Our school was dilapidated, the roads we walked were muddy, trying to get to and from school, but there was something special. One, in our home, where our father loved us, our mother loved us. She died at a very early age, and our father became a single parent with five children, and struggled to keep, shall we say, borrowing from Jesse Jackson, to keep hope alive and maintained a house of love and dignity, and shared with us the stories of the ancestors, including his father, who was born, our grandfather, born in 1861, enslaved, And both stories became teaching instruments and candles in the darkness. You are familiar with that phrase.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
As I said earlier, our family was connected with the local church, and not just one church, but local churches, because the churches had an unusual bond of mutual support and cooperation. So it was not just the church where you held membership that was an encouraging force, but all the churches in the neighborhood played a role. And these were the kind of dynamic forces in our lives, and I cannot thank God enough for that community in the midst of injustice that held together, lifted us, and encouraged us. Some of the people could not write their names, but just to have them greet you and say, son or daughter, I'm praying for you. And to give you encouragement to go on. These are realities that we shall never cease to thank God for. And I keep lifting up the family, the church, the academy, the school. And these were so intertwined, so interconnected, so interconnected that they were inseparable, because in some sense we embraced them 7 days a week. And that was institutionalized, shall I say, on the campus of Morehouse College, because there our president, faculty, administrators, and staff carried that same spirit in higher education that we had witnessed in that Jim Crow segregated community trying to grow up and claim and hold on to dignity and integrity against great odds.
Dr. Moss, you just mentioned Morehouse College. I spent the last 19 months there as an administrator, and I've come to learn a lot about Morehouse and the experiences of Morehouse, the alums, yourself being one, your son, Martin Luther King, who you've developed a relationship with, a friendship with. What does Morehouse College mean to you today versus what Morehouse College meant to you while you were going through? Is there a distinctive difference? Or put it this way, is Morehouse or schools like Morehouse, HBCUs, needed now more today than when you matriculated?
I would say equally as necessary today as they were 100 years ago. These are the institutions that kept the candle aglow. When lynching was legal, Jim Crow was worshipped, and I mean that literally, and injustice was enforced. These institutions then and now practiced not they didn't just teach, but they practiced democracy. They lived the moral and spiritual principles that many people talk about but seldom experience. Whether it was in chapel, listening to a lecture from Dr. Mays, or in a classroom where the professor, no matter what the subject was, always found time to deal with the injustices then and now. So if you were in a class in biology, that biology professor brought more than scientific genius to the class, but a special kind of testimony and experience that was passed on to the students. And that was education plus. Consequently, the student body was extended family. We felt the necessity to help each other, to challenge each other, and to, in a sense, rescue each other. I remember Dr. Mays saying to us in one setting, if along the way you find a Morehouse man on the wrong path, it's your responsibility, your duty, your calling to help him get back on the right path. That to me is the meaning of a liberal arts education. It's not just engineering and science and a mastery of economic theories and political science skills, but it's also, excuse me, it's also a mission. A mission to help to share in building a more perfect union and a more just world. And at my graduation, Adam Clayton Powell, keynote speaker, said during the message, "You must go from here with a sense of mission. Martin Luther King Jr. is waiting for you to come and march with him." For some of us, that was not oratory. It was literal fact, challenge, and mission. And I could even say some of us followed it for the rest of our lives.
So, Dr. Moss, Morehouse, you've just rattled off a couple of names that in our experience as people of color, I'm from Jamaica, so I came here to the U.S., so I'm learning a lot about my African-American brothers and sisters and the history and their journey I knew nothing of growing up in Jamaica, but going to Howard, I got a good sense of what that's like. I got a good sense of it. But you matriculated from Morehouse, and you are known nationally and internationally as one of the brightest theologians that most have ever encountered. So after your Morehouse experience, what happened next? Where did Dr. Moss go next, and what drove you to what's next post the Morehouse?
Next was seminary. And when I acknowledged as a teenager, 17 years old, my call to the ministry, I sought out an individual to share my yearning, my calling, who happened to have been a Morehouse man. And he said to me something that I have tried to pass on to other aspiring women and men in ministry and in all other fields. He said to me that a call to ministry is, first of all, a call to preparation. And that is primary. Basic, 4 years of college, 3 years of seminary, and all beyond that, that you can attain. I took his advice seriously, his counsel, and then, lo and behold, I found, maybe in different words, his counsel reaffirmed as I entered the campus of Morehouse. And it was a daily reaffirmation of what he had passed on to me. And I found our professors, our instructors, our counselors reinforcing that along the way. So, after college, seminary, and along the way, participation in the civil rights movement. The first was the NAACP. I became one, at that time, the youngest member of the board of the Atlanta chapter NAACP, and then later vice president of the Atlanta NAACP. I was a young student pastor in Atlanta and participated both in as a student and as a community person in things like voter registration and voter turnout. So this was a part of all of my total life's curriculum. And then, while still in school, as an older student, joined with some of my younger friends and colleagues to participate in the student sit-in movement, and was a part of the founding of the Committee on Appeal for Human Rights, which was our college and university human rights movement in Atlanta, in concert with all of the other black colleges across the land.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, this has been not a choice, but an obligation, a calling.
Mm.
It is as necessary as inhaling and exhaling.
Wow. So I'm sitting here just listening to your words, Dr. Moss, and you know, I know quite a bit of you from my time there. You said it's a life calling. So is it that every step along the way you took, from growing up in your household, the influence of your father, going to Morehouse, going to seminary, all of that is preparation, so to speak, for the life that you have lived and the impact that you have had. How do you convey that to young people or people today who are seeking and searching for what I will call a purpose, as you mentioned in your sermon at Howard, a purpose and a mission? How do you convey that to young people today? Is it through mentorship, or is it through witnessing, or is it just through existing and having them see you and what you have experienced? I often struggle with that because you see what's happening in our society today with people not necessarily, you know, losing hope with COVID and all these types of things. But
yes, yes.
Life in general seems to follow narrow paths and ups and downs. So how do you convey such messages to young people and people who are still searching today?
First of all, I think we have to love them and embrace them and listen to them without trying to lecture them. And I think when we love them because they are our family, embrace them, and give to them a listening ear and an outreach spirit. Before you know it, they will pour on you a confidence and a special kind of respect. Not that they will, you will always agree, but we are family, and we must have and give to each other the listening ear and the loving heart. And once we establish that as the platform, we can spend a lifetime communicating, encouraging, helping, debating, etc. But if we do not give to them the listening ear and a loving heart, they are not going to give to us the kind of community building that we all need. We might use a different language from time to time, and our music might be slightly different, but if we listen to it carefully, it's in unison.
Yes.
This is something that I think we must all teach and learn. And they're not expecting us to cue in on all of that language. That can become a turnoff. But they do want us to hear their sounds, their joys, their sorrows. And after a while, we begin to discover that there is so much in harmony. I think Du Bois talked about a melody and a harmony in an ill-harmonizing and unmelodious land. And that's what we have to connect with constantly. We can learn from them, and they, in turn, can learn from us. But it can't be a forced lesson. It has to grow out of mutual respect, unconditional love, and finding some unity in the struggle. And I won't extend this too long, but I will give you an example after the next question. of how old Black Lives Matter really is.
Well, Dr. Moss, I think that's a question, that's an interesting segue, because your life and your history is wrapped up in the civil rights movement. You're pastoring, you're volunteering, your advocacy. Can you talk a little bit about that movement and what that meant to you and what you see now? As you mentioned Black Lives Matter, but would you have thought from all that you did in your early years to be now in 2020, 2021, seeing some of the same things that yourself and Dr. King and Ambassador Young and all the pioneers I called you, is would you have imagined seeing the same things, or have we not learned anything over the years, or are we just going around in circles?
I think we have learned much. Those of my generation, I think, expected to see much more in our own time and space. And there were times when we did not realize the full impact of what we were doing or trying to do. Sometimes we thought we were failing, only to learn decades later how much we did really succeed. We expected justice and equality and the compliance with those principles to come much sooner. That was a disappointment. So we had to not readjust to injustice, but recognize that we are in a generational struggle. And each generation passes on to the next all of their collected wisdom and mistakes. And we take those, examine them, and learn to grow. But let me say this. Given all of the ugliness, the hate, the attacks, and the indescribable brutalities that are taking place, we still elected Barack Obama, President of the United States. Now, we can spend a lot of time talking about how he was blocked by folk like Senator Mitch McConnell and others. But you can never disclaim or downplay the fact that he was elected twice against great odds and brought wisdom and dignity to the office. The president and first lady, most admired not throughout the world, in the midst of Fox News and Mitch McConnell and all of those ugly forces. So I will not despair, and we cannot despair when we turn on Fox News and all we get is a misinterpretation and ugly propaganda. But you can still in that environment, you get a Stacey Abrams and a Senator Raphael Warnock and a Senator two senators from Georgia, Ossoff and Warnock, in the midst of the ugliness of a Donald Trump. That's something to behold. And whereas the gubernatorial election was stolen from Stacey Abrams, they had to disenfranchise some 800,000 voters in order to defeat her. And that is remarkable. And in that act and process and practice of injustice and disenfranchisement, she did not go home in despair. She went to work under the theme Fair Vote. And if she had just gone home in bitterness, we wouldn't have Senator Warnock and Ossoff in the Senate today, giving us, with Vice President Harris, a majority vote in the Senate. So we must recognize the ugliness of January 6th and the mob, the insurrectionists. But we must also recognize that in the midst of a mob, we still got two senators, a president and a vice president, almost beyond what the average mind would expect in the history of our nation.
Wow. So when you look and you look at current events today, and you being a theologian and the gospel message rings true through you as a servant of our Lord and Savior, do you see hope in the midst of all of this in terms of where we're headed? Knowing that we're in the midst, and you said something very interesting in the sermon at Howard. You said, yea, though I walk through the valley, but if you drop the V, it's alley. I found that very interesting, because there are many alleys I walked in Washington, D.C. that I was fearful. But yes. using that metaphor, what are the alleys you see that we're going to have to walk down if we are to get to this, what you call the perfect union? Because I've been blessed to work in higher education at both HBCUs and PWIs. Mm-hmm. And yes. I see good people all around me in terms of their ability, their wanting to have just live their lives. But there are the fringes, if you will. But they create these alleys for us to walk down. Can you talk to us a little bit about these alleys that you see, good, bad, or indifferent?
Now, it is interesting that you make that reference, because our society, our culture, is filled with alleys, intentionally created the alleys of mass incarceration, the alleys of destroying our public school system in order to nullify the implementation of the Supreme Court decision of 1954. The alleys of disenfranchisement and the creation of congressional districts through gerrymandering. The alleys of inadequate health care and housing and transportation. However, remember that our HBCUs were born in the midst of these alleys. So a Howard University gives us a vice president. A Morehouse College gives us a Martin Luther King Jr. and the first senator ever from the state of Georgia, African-American senator. And not only that, but we have even learned how to turn the alleys into academies and meadows and tables. So we can say in that same psalm, thou preparest a table before me in the presence. Isn't that powerful?
That is powerful.
In the presence of our enemies. A table. So you can't get hung up on looking at the enemy. You have to keep nursing and nurturing the table. And some people get discouraged before the table because they can't see the vision on the table because of the noise of the enemy. And a deacon in our church used to say, don't look at your enemy, look at your table. And I think that has to be taught and practiced. Howard University is a table in the presence of our enemies. Morehouse College, Spelman College, and all of the HBCUs are tables in the desert, tables in the alley.
In the alley, that's right. That alley, Dr. Moss, I tell you, when I heard you mention that in their sermon, It struck differently for me, because we can read a psalm and we try to exegete the text, but dropping the V off of valley, it makes it real for us in our modern day society. But I do have this question for you, and I'll draw
sure.
upon your theologian, your pastoral acumen and skill and gift. I call it a gift. Pastors, I believe pastors are gifted for the work they're supposed to do if they are being led by the Spirit of God. But for the folks that will be listening to this podcast and they hear all that you have said, how do we translate all of what we see in front of us into a message of hope? I keep coming back to the word hope, because
yes.
in the midst of these alleys, the alleys are dark. You don't know what's down the street, down the alley.
Yes, yes.
And we're probably saying to ourselves, I'm not going down that path. But it's actually down that path you have to go. You mentioned the story of Frederick Douglass and him having a physical fight with his slave owner and him leaving and going all the way to England and coming back and going back to visit his slave master, not as a slave, but as a marshal. He had to go down a dark path to realize his truth. How, What kind of message could you share with us today from a pastoral emphasis that would highlight a story such as powerful as the one you shared about Frederick Douglass?
And you know, the interesting thing about that visit, this slave master, former slave master, who was in his advanced years and slowly dying, said, "Come in, Marshall Douglass." Now, that's a revolution within itself. And Douglass, I understand, initiated the visit. So here you have a living free man, a living free person going to visit with a dying ex-slave master. That's a powerful metaphor. And the slave master has enough, I guess, civility to address him as he enters his door as Marshall Douglass. Quite a distinction between Marshall Douglass and slave Douglass and enslaved Douglass. And I think we have to constantly look for these breakthroughs, places of light. And that scripture says, "I walk through the valley or the alley." Not, you know, building there a shelter of despair, but I walk through the valley, through the alley. So no matter how ugly things are, if we maintain our integrity, our faith, our dreams, our purpose, we can constantly see light breaking through in spite of and because of and often in memory of those who have suffered and sacrificed that we might achieve and grow.
Such powerful words, Dr. Moss, and I know that we are close to time, and one of the things I probably would want to ask you to do a part two, because I really wanted to talk a little bit more about your impact internationally. You and I, before we got on air, about 2 weeks ago actually, we spoke about your visit to my homeland of Jamaica and meeting Michael Manley, and you were sharing a story about that, but you have a career and a life that is unusual by many stretch of the imagination. You're known both nationally and internationally. You've been known to advise presidents and praying in various and sundry settings to lift up and inspire, but not only nationally, but internationally. But in the time that we have remaining, could you just talk a little bit about what prompted you to go to Jamaica and did you enjoy yourself? I guess that's a very simple question.
You know, that first trip to Jamaica was really a gift. And I say it was a gift because they had really wanted or invited Dr. Martin Luther King Sr. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., of course, was deceased. They wanted Dr. Martin Luther King Sr. And he said, "I cannot come, but I would highly recommend one of my sons, and that was his kind of personality, Otis Moss Jr. And they said, fine. And I went, and lo and behold, a part of our welcoming, my wife and I were welcomed, Edwin and I were welcomed by Michael Manley and his wife and mother, and a member of the city council, and one of the there were two unforgettable moments in that visit. We went to the grave sites of Norman Washington Manley, the father of Michael Manley, and also the grave of that great liberationist who worked for a while in America. You can call his name Garvey. And we placed wreaths at both graves, at the gravesite of each. And I discovered, not knowing before, how Marcus Garvey is celebrated in Jamaica. And you can help, you can help enlighten that reality, that historic reality. Michael Manley was seeking to become prime minister of Jamaica at the time, and he succeeded in that. But guess what? When I discovered that Mrs. Amy Garvey was still alive and living in Jamaica, I asked for an audience with her. And our host said that they thought they could arrange that, and they later told me that we have gotten you 15 minutes. I said, we'll take it. Gladly. The 15 minutes turned into 2 hours.
Wow.
And she did most of the talking, which was fine. And that, you know, all of that grew out of that moment when Daddy King said, I cannot go, but I would like Otis Moss Jr. to go in my place, so I can never cease to be grateful for that opportunity, that door. And I think, as I reflect on it, it is the responsibility of those of us who reach the stage of parents or elders, mentors. We must keep opening doors for those around us and those coming after us. And I will say a quick thing, and this is sort of off the subject. Sometimes we allow language, words, even terminology to get in our way. And we have to grow, I guess, to deal with language and always constantly use it as an instrument of liberation. When you hear Black Lives Matter, we ought to think historically. Richard Allen walked out of the white Methodist church because he had been humiliated pulled up from praying and ordered to go to the balcony. Out of that was born the African Methodist Episcopal Church.
Mm-hmm.
A pretty powerful instrument
mm-hmm.
in African American, in the African American religious experience. What Richard Allen was really saying was, black worship matters.
Mm-hmm.
Black lives matter. Mm-hmm. In 1909, an organization was established called the National Association for the Advancement of who? Colored
people.
The NAACP. An affirmation that black lives matter.
Mm-hmm.
The whole sit-in movement lifted up the fact that black lives matter. So sometimes we recoil or we step back from a piece of our own history because we don't take time to learn from it.
Mm-hmm.
So our young sisters who brought into being Black Lives Matter were really carrying on the tradition of Richard Allen, W.B. Du Bois, Carter G. Woodson,
mm-hmm.
And many, many more.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is something we owe to the next generation, to embrace them with love and history.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That is so powerful, Dr. Moss. Well, as I said to you when we got on, I could speak to you for 2, 3, 4 hours. But,
and I have gone over my time.
Yeah.
Your well, time also.
Yeah, but Dr. Moss, as I met with, we've had Ambassador Young on the podcast as well, and I am blessed to have the opportunity to speak with leaders and icons like yourself, because I find myself now spending more time with the elders, is what I tell my children. I spend the time with the elders because everything that I am going through now in what I call midlife, there's someone I can point to see an example of how they made it through and the impact that they left. And I'm very deeply humbled by this time that you have spent with me. But what I'll do to close, Dr. Moss, is I give all my guests an opportunity to just share some words, some closing comments and words of wisdom or anything that this audience can take away by way of inspiration and affirmation, if you will, that we're probably in this alley, but we will get out of it at some point in time.
Yes, you know, Dean Carter, Dean Lawrence Carter, Dean of the Martin Luther King Chapel at Morehouse College, person you know well,
mm-hmm.
wrote a book maybe 2 years ago, and he talks about his continuing growth. And a chapter in his book, well, the book overall talks about a Baptist preacher learning from a Buddhist.
Yes.
And in one chapter in his book, he talks about turning poison into medicine. And I found that to be highly instructive and challenging. And it seems to me that a part of our mission in the struggle and in life is learning how and teaching others how to turn poison into medicine.
Hmm.
And we can go on living and helping others to live. Dr. King often said, hate cannot overcome hate. Only love can do that. And we must be disciples and physicians in overcoming hate with love and overcoming inaction with creative action and turning poison into medicine. And thereby we become healers.
Wow. Dr. Moss, thank you so much, sir, for your wisdom, your knowledge, your service, and quite frankly, I will say this as a seminary graduate myself, your integrity in preaching and teaching the gospel. I believe it's something that we need to hear more and more. I had a very interesting debate with a couple of my high school colleagues this past weekend about the relevancy of the gospel. And sir, you embody that. And I just thank you for spending an hour with me. We both ran over time, but as the old preachers used to say, when as the Spirit leads. So thank you so much. Thank you so much, Dr. Moss. And I greatly appreciate it. Thank you so much. And ladies and gentlemen, go ahead, sir.
May your good works continue. It's an honor to be with you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. That's so kind and powerful coming from you, sir. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that completes this week's episode of It's Easy, Son, your life lessons on your journey to your purpose. As always, the feedback that we received and the comments about the authenticity of our guests and the way in which they impact you, I trust and believe and I pray and hope that today's episode will give you something to hold on to such that you can see that there is a way out of this alley. So until next time, this is It's Easy, Son, your life lessons on your journey to your purpose. Take care, be safe, and God bless.